What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting the leaders of Israel and the U.S. meet in Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are trying to find ways to cope with the toughening security situation in the Middle East.
The security environment in the Middle East has deteriorated in many areas. And as I've said repeatedly, the security of Israel is one of my top foreign policy priorities.
The two leaders have often had a fractious relationship, and their meeting was the first in more than a year. A Jordanian police officer killed four people Monday at a police training facility just outside the capital, Amman. The dead include two Americans, a South African, and two Jordanians. A number of people were wounded. Edward Uranian reports.
Monday's attack took place at the King Abdullah Special Operations Training Center in a suburb of Amman. The facility is used to train Iraqi and Palestinian security forces. Jordan's King Abdullah blasted the culprit behind Monday's attack. He says it was a cowardly attack, but many regional countries have also been hit by similar violence. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
The United Nations top diplomat in Somalia, Nicholas Kay, says the country is steadily transforming from a failed state to a recovering one. Kay addressed a special session of the UN Security Council on Somalia. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi's political party has won the first seats in what is expected to be a landslide victory in Sunday's parliamentary elections. The results have been slow in arriving. The National League for Democracy party says it will win the vast majority of the seats. This is VOA News. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond says stepped-up security measures have slowed his country's flights out of Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Hammond says a backlog is expected to be cleared by the end of this week. Thousands of foreigners have been trying to leave the resort in the wake of a deadly October 31st air crash, possibly caused by terrorists. Russia should be banned from competing in athletics. That's the stark conclusion of a report from a commission set up by the World Anti-Doping Agency to look into allegations of corruption in Russian sports. The investigation claimed that Russia is, in effect, running a state-sponsored doping program. Henry Ridgewell reports.
From the peaceful surroundings of Geneva, the World Anti-Doping Agency set off a new earthquake to shake the foundations of global sport. Accusations that Russia has for years been conducting a state-supported doping program in athletics. Dick Pound is head of the commission looking into the allegations.
We have found cover-ups. We found destruction of samples in the laboratories. We found payments of money in order to conceal doping tests.
Moscow's Minister for Sport strongly denied the allegations. Henry Ridgewell, London.
Lawmakers in Spain's Catalonia region approved a measure Monday for a renewed effort to seek independence. A majority in the regional parliament backed the plan. They hope the process will lead to secession within 18 months, but
el gobierno que presido no va a permitir que esto continúe.
Spain's Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy says he will not let the process continue and promises to use all political and legal means to stop the push for Catalan independence. The president of the University of Missouri and the chancellor at the school's main campus both announced Monday that they are resigning their positions, giving in to a key demand of racial protesters. The protesters accuse the leaders of not adequately dealing with racial discrimination on campus and other types of discrimination. Tim Wolf, the university's president, made an emotional resignation announcement at a meeting of the school's governing body. A report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says faltering international trade may slow global economic growth by one-tenth of a percentage point to 2.9% this year. The report was released today. Candidates in Uganda's February presidential election officially began their campaigning Monday, while Human Rights Watch is calling for the government to ensure what they call a level playing field for everyone. Eight candidates are running, including President Yoweri Museveni and opposition leader Kizza Besigye. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes ended the day lower today. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Security Council discusses the crisis in Burundi as Human Rights Watch calls for a concerted action to avert a disaster.
This is about preventive diplomacy. It's not too late to avoid the worst-case scenario for Burundi. So we need for the Security Council to send a very strong political signal that violence will not be tolerated.
Philippe Boulopion is the United Nations and Crisis Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. President Buhari replaces the country's anti-corruption chief. A call for indigenous people to have rights to their land and forests. And a top UN diplomat says 2016 is a pivotal year for Somalia's recovery.
At last, Somalia is facing the problems of a country coming together rather than falling apart.
Nicholas Kay is the UN Somalia envoy. A prayer meeting for a missing Zimbabwe's political activist 8 months after his abduction, and Kenyan herders embrace drought-resistant trees. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch says the situation in Burundi is a test case for preventive diplomacy and the international community needs to be much more involved. Philippe Boulopion, the United Nations and Crisis Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, says the international community should not wait until Burundi spins out of control. This comes as the UN Security Council met Monday to discuss the crisis in Burundi, where there has been an uptick in violence, raising fears of a possible return to the 1994 Rwanda genocide. Boulopion said the Security Council must send a strong signal to all Burundians that further violence will not be tolerated and that those who incite hate crimes will be sanctioned.
The Security Council was really put on notice by senior UN officials that the situation in Burundi could spin out of control and that strong Security Council action was needed to avert the worst there before it's too late. So hopefully this was a defining moment, the kind of wake-up call the UN Security Council needed to start really addressing the crisis in Burundi.
So what do you think the Security Council can do now? Are they discussing sanctions or what's going to happen to stop the killing there?
Well, this is about preventive diplomacy. It's not too late to avoid the worst-case scenario for Burundi. So we need for the Security Council to send a very strong political signal that violence will not be tolerated. For example, that people who incite the commission of serious crimes by inciting to violence or hatred will face individual sanctions. The Security Council should also look into beefing up the UN presence in the country. Right now, the UN had an electoral mission that's packing up and leaving, probably at the time when the UN is most needed in the country. The UN Security Council should also look into the possible deployment of an international or regional police force to calm the situation in some of the neighborhoods of Bujumbura. Ideas along those lines have been put forward by the AU, and the UN needs to support that and participate in this discussion.
When you talk to the government people in Burundi, they claimed the violence that's going on is being done by those who are opposed to President Pierre Nkurunziza. Now, the president gave a November 7th deadline for people, so-called people with weapons, to turn them in. How is it being interpreted, the role the Burundian government is playing?
Well, you know, we would certainly not dispute the government as a legitimate interest in ensuring that people do not possess weapons illegally or do not use these weapons to attack policemen, for example. But the fact that, you know, some members of the political opposition are armed and in some cases attacking policemen does not give the government a license to go and kill civilians in these neighborhoods or to terrorize entire neighborhoods or to use, excessive or indiscriminate force in the process of going after armed people. So we do not contest that the government might be facing some security challenges. But again, that's not a license to go after civilians.
Is the Security Council concerned, let's say, about the ghosts of 1994?
Well, You know, judging by the speeches that were given by the UN officials, and in particular the UN advisor on the prevention of genocide, it seems to be definitely a concern in the minds of senior UN officials or diplomats in the Security Council, the fact that the Burundian president of the Senate has used charged language that reminded some to language that was used before and during the Rwandan genocide, certainly caused for great concern.
Philip Bolopion is the United Nations and Crisis Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. He was speaking with me from New York City. Burundi's foreign minister denied Monday that his country is in an escalating spiral of violence. Alain Nyamitwe told an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council via a video link from Bujumbura that the country in general is calm and that citizens are moving about peacefully. He said there are some neighborhoods in the capital where crime is ongoing, but he questioned remarks by the envoy of the African Union, who expressed concern that the violence is spreading beyond the capital. AU envoy Tete Antonio told the council that the surge in violence and serious human rights violations has sent 200,000 Burundians fleeing to Tanzania, Rwanda, Uganda, and the DRC. He also warned about inflammatory statements by officials, saying such statements are unacceptable given the painful past of the Great Lakes region. The UN's top diplomat in Somalia said Monday that the country is well advanced in its transformation from a failed state to a recovering one. Nicholas Kay told the UN Security Council that 2016 will be a decisive year for Somalia on several fronts. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir has more.
In his final briefing to the council after more than 2 years as the UN's envoy in Somalia, Kay said the country is moving away from the chaos that defined it for more than two decades.
At last, Somalia is facing the problems of a country coming together rather than falling apart.
Kay noted work on organizing the country's numerous regions into states is slowly progressing and urged a swift conclusion to that process. Next year's elections will also be an important benchmark. Kay said they must be conducted on time and be more inclusive than 2012's vote. The envoy also noted that no major commercial ship has been seized by pirates off Somalia's coast for more than 3 years. One ongoing spoiler to Somalia's recovery is the Al-Shabaab terrorist group, which continues to attack government and civilian targets, carrying out a deadly bombing on a well-known hotel just over a week ago. Meanwhile, the road for Somalia's recovery is long. Some 3.2 million people still need assistance to survive, and the UN is warning that projected flooding and drought could make the situation worse. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says the president has named a new chief for the country's anti-corruption agency, also known as the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, or the EFCC. Garba Shehu, senior special assistant to the president on media and publicity, said the new acting chief is Ibrahim Mustafa Magu, who is Nigeria's assistant commissioner of police. He replaces Ibrahim Lamodi, an appointee of former President Goodluck Jonathan. Lamodi was recently the subject of a controversy involving various alleged corruption cases. Shehu would not say whether Mr. Lamodi had been forced out, except to say that Lamodi was going on a terminal leave effective yesterday, Monday, ahead of the formal expiration of his tenure in February next year.
Ibrahim Lamodi has been asked to go on terminal leave. He has up to February next year to serve his term. The government decision is that he can take his accumulated leave and step aside. Yes, the government has asked one of the senior directors of the organization to take over the interim. The acting chairman, Ibrahim Magu, has been asked to take over.
Did Mr. Lamodi request this terminal leave that you're talking about? Did he request it, or was it at the request of the presidency?
At this time, I'm not in a position to know whether he requested for it or he was asked. Of course, it is the prerogative of the president to determine if such a request should be approved. But I think he's been advised to go and finish the vacation.
Shehu, I mean, how was he doing in terms of the president's war on corruption? Was he doing a good job, or do you think the president has confidence in him?
Again, it's difficult to say in a direct way whether the issue is one of confidence or the lack of it. As with the many other officers in government, this one too was inherited by the new administration. He was there doing the job or not doing it, depending on where you stand or what you are leading at. But apparently, I think he had tried to respond, you know, to the new, to the Buhari environment that come onto the scene in the country. And I guess lately he has done quite a lot to make an impression. Whether it was too little, too late, what I don't know. But the president decides.
So, Mr. Lamodi, had he been kind of suspected of any past deals, you know, that were under the microscope or what?
Well, as it is, he's not under any investigation that I know of under the present government of Muhammadu Buhari. Yes, he has his difficulties with the Nigerian Senate. The Senate is investigating a number of concluded transactions under him, and that's entirely for the Senate to decide whether his departure would bring to an end
investigations, or they would intensify. That was Garba Shehu, a senior special assistant on media and publicity to President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Today is Tuesday, November 10th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa. On the Voice of America, I'm James Barton, Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send a special shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, and Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamanda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa, time is now 17 and a half minutes past the hour. The World Resources Institute says ensuring the right of indigenous groups to their land and community forest is a key way to combat deforestation and climate change. Peter Vitt, director of Land and Resources Rights Initiative, tells Ricky Shryak how government actions to protect community forests are one way nations can aim to achieve their climate targets ahead of the upcoming Paris Climate Conference next month.
In many parts of the world, particularly in Africa, land is held collectively by communities or indigenous people. And our work has focused on the land that includes forests. And so community forests are that part of community land, or the commons, if you like, that include forests on them.
How does WRI then think it can help stop deforestation in places like West Africa with programs like Community Forest Tenure?
So our interests are to conduct research, policy research, and to review legislation, draft bills, and to share some of the policy recommendations that come out of that analysis. We also develop tools that community leaders, government officials, donor agencies can use in helping them make more evidence-based decisions. With regard to this economic assessment that we've done, our real interest is in reaching finance ministers and donor agencies and encourage them to look at the results of this research, and hopefully that will sway them to invest more in securing collective rights because of both the economic and the environmental benefits that come from secure tenure.
What are some of the challenges to having countries achieve secure tenure?
Our land reform is not easy to do. It's politically charged. Land is such a source of wealth and therefore source of power in so many countries around the world. So getting a reform on land is not a simple task. There are a lot of stakeholders involved. For communities and indigenous people in particular, the way that they manage their land is that they oftentimes allocate a portion of their land for use by the community as a whole, the so-called common or common property within community lands. And that land is usually forest lands or wetlands or rivers and streams or pastures, and they're meant to be used by everyone that's a member of that community. Many governments view that land as underutilized and view that land as vacant, idle, and therefore available for investment. So it's that land that's most at risk from expropriation. It's most at risk to be allocated to investors, and it's very often not recognized by the state as community land. They will recognize land that is community land that's used as homesteads and family farms, but they don't recognize the land that is managed as common property usually.
That was Peter Vitt, Director of Land and Resources Rights Initiative at the World Resources Institute. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. More than 60 people attended a prayer meeting on Monday in Harare for missing Zimbabwe political activist Itai Zamora, who was abducted by unknown assailants exactly 8 months ago. Charles Yoni, a member of Zamora's Occupy Africa Unity Square movement, says the people who attended the prayer meeting expressed concern over lack of police action on the Zamora abduction.
We had a short mini prayer meeting with people from all walks of life and people from different churches gathering between the lunch hour to just pray to God and to remember Itai in solidarity with his family.
Now, we remember that at one stage you were trying to engage the office of the president. What happened?
We did try at some time going back to engage the office of the president, and we have written several numerous letters and petitions, but nothing has come out from that. So right now we have engaged again for the third time the lawyers for human rights, that they should now revisit the court of law and let the High Court intervene once again so that the state would react accordingly.
When are they filing the papers, and what exactly are they looking at here now?
Now what we are looking at is the police. Ever since they were ordered during that case that the lawyers won, they were ordered to give a periodic report after every 2 weeks to show what exactly they are doing and what exactly they have so far gathered. But ever since that time, nothing has come to light and nothing they have said anything. So now we are asking the court again to reissue another order, and this time they be charged police with contempt of court.
That was Charles Yoni, a member of Occupy Africa Unity Square, speaking from Harare with Gabe Dube of VOA's Zimbabwe service. In northern Kenya, recurrent drought and desertification are hitting livestock-dependent communities hard. Lenny Ruvaga reports for VOA from the Samburu region, where families are hoping to root out malnutrition by planting 18 species of drought-resistant fruit-bearing trees.
Early morning in Samburu, 10-year-old Erla Lenguris is having her only meal of the day, porridge mixed with cooking oil, before heading out to tend to her father's herd of goats. Her father, Mark Lenguris, earns around $100 a month. The family's diet mainly consists of rice, polenta, and beans. It's what they can afford and what's available. Samburu gets low rainfall throughout the year. Drought is common. Herders can travel more than 160 kilometers in search of green pasture.
The grazing ground for cattle, camel, or sheep is just so scarce. So that's why I have some option of half farming, because there's no ground to graze, nowhere to take our animals to get grass.
Lenguris started planting fruit trees about a year ago as part of a United Nations-funded initiative by Savannah Kenya. Today, they plant Moringa stenopetela. Its leaves can be eaten raw or cooked and are good sources of calcium, iron, and other key vitamins like A and C.
In an area like this, there needs to be more food production, a greater diversity, and with more trees that can provide it, especially food-producing trees that we plant. And with great diversity comes a greater diversity of nutrition that's available and healthier people.
They are planting other trees also indigenous to the region that need little water, like African oak and desert date trees. The community expects its first harvest in about a year. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Samburu, Kenya.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Marco Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Nigeria Golden Eaglets captain Kelechi Nwakali is the Adidas Golden Ball Award winner at the just-concluded FIFA Under-17 World Cup, FIFA revealed in Viña del Mar, Chile, on Sunday. The midfielder received the award for the tournament's best player. Nigerian striker Victor Osimhen received the Adidas Silver Ball Award for scoring the most goals at the tournament. He scored 10 goals, which is a new tournament record. Mali, who lost to Nigeria 2-0 in the final and our African under-17 champions, had also something to cheer. Industrious attacking midfielder Ali Male received the Adidas Bronze Ball Award. However, Mali's biggest accolade for an individual player went to goalkeeper Samuel Diarra, who received the Adidas Golden Glove Award for being the tournament's best custodian. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, WHO, has declared Sierra Leone free of the deadly Ebola virus, WHO revealed in Geneva, Switzerland. Consequently, Sierra Leone can now once again organize football matches. The Confederation of African Football banned the playing of football in the Mano River region, which includes Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, in August last year. This was aimed at preventing the spread of the Ebola virus. As a result, Sierra Leone hosted their home fixtures in Morocco, Cameroon, and Nigeria. Now, Sierra Leone can stage their first international match at home since they hosted Seychelles in Freetown in July last year in an Africa Cup of Nations qualifier. The WHO says Sierra Leone now enters a 90-day period of enhanced surveillance. In athletics, the Association of International Marathons and Distance Races, AIMS, crowned Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge and Ethiopian Mary Dibaba the 2015 Best Male and Female Runners of the Year. Kipchoge won the London Marathon in 2 hours, 4 minutes and 42 seconds in April, which was the world's leading time until he improved it at the Berlin Marathon with a winning time of 2 hours and 4 minutes in September. Dibaba won the Women's Xiamen Marathon in China in January in 2 hours 19 minutes and 52 seconds. She was runner-up at the Boston Marathon in the United States of America in April before winning the marathon at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China in August. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. An official of the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch says the situation in Burundi is a test case for preventive diplomacy and the international community needs to be much more involved. Philip Bolopion, the United Nations and Crisis Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, says the international community should not wait until Burundi spins out of control. This comes as the UN Security Council met Monday to discuss the crisis in Burundi, where there has been an uptick in violence, raising fears of a possible return to the 1994 Rwanda genocide. Meanwhile, Burundi's foreign minister denied Monday that his country is in an escalating spiral of violence. That is it for this Monday, November 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark O'Woman, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you make this week a very productive one.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is facing his toughest challenge yet. Join host Shaka Ssali and his guests as they explore the possibility of major opposition leaders, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and Dr. Kizza Besigye joining forces in next year's Ugandan poll. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.